Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today we're looking at a video from a channel called Apologia Studios, which attempts to answer the question, how do you know the Bible is true? Well, personally, I would suggest that the Bible is too large of a book, spanning too many time periods, locations, and genres, to just take it as a singular piece and apply the label true or false. I would rather break it down and look at the smaller pieces, and when such an approach is taken, we find that the Bible contains many demonstrably true things, and many demonstrably false things. It also makes a bunch of claims that are just plain untestable. But given how mixed its reliability is, I am not inclined to just trust that it is accurate for the untestable portions. But let's see how they answer this question. Also, today I'm kicking off my annual fundraiser for Project Share, so if you'd like to do some good in the world, stay tuned to the end of the video for details.
That's really good. So a lot of times, people will approach the issue of the truth of the Bible in, a couple different ways. So you might have an epistemology. But don't let the word throw you, especially if you're young in this room. You're like, I have no idea what that means. All it means is this. The epistemology is a theory of knowledge. How do you know? That's the question. How do you know the Bible is true?
Well, epistemology, in oversimplified, generalized terms, is the question of how you know what you know, and understanding how to work through your epistemology is an important tool to have. There are many different approaches to epistemology, and in life it's generally best to take a varied approach. Not all aspects of your life require the same epistemological rigor, and which aspects require more rigor than others will depend on your own circumstances. I don't need to make absolutely sure that I am buying the best kitchen knife available, doing in-depth research and analysis, looking at scientific studies to figure out which materials make the best knife, etc. I just want a good knife, so if I read user reviews and they seem mostly happy, that's probably good enough for me. But a professional chef in a high-end restaurant might want to spend a bit more time on the research than I would. And actually, I used to sell knives, and we were told in our training to not even bother trying to sell to chefs, because they will be attached to their own knives and won't be willing to change their minds. It was presented as though they were dogmatic about their knives, but looking back, I now feel that it was more of a chefs actually know their stuff when it comes to knives, and so won't fall for our gimmicks. And just as a bit of advice for my younger viewers, if you ever see a job advertisement for Vector Marketing or Cutco, don't even bother applying. They are exploitative as fuck. I'm not sure that I would classify them as a multi-level marketing scam like a lot of other people have, but that doesn't mean that they're a good company to work for.
A lot of times people will say this, well, we know things based upon reason. Right? Logic. Is it logical? Is it reasonable? So if it's consistent with logic, then that's how you know that it's true. Some people are empiricists. They believe that you know things based upon observation. So what would that look like? Well, you know it based upon testing it, observation. I've experienced it. I've seen it in front of me. Scientific experimentation, right?
Etc., etc. Yeah, there are different forms of epistemology, not all of which are universally applicable, and whose usefulness varies depending on the situation. Now, get to your point already.
So some people might say this, well, we know the Bible is true because there's all these evidences that we stack up that seem to show that it's most probable that God exists and the Bible is God's revelation.
Yeah, a lot of people do say that. Unfortunately, that approach doesn't really hold up to scrutiny. The pile of evidence might look impressive from a distance, but when examined closely, each piece of evidence usually ends up being something weak. Like, this Old Testament verse that wasn't even a prophecy vaguely looks like it might draw a parallel with something that was said to have happened in the New Testament, therefore it was a fulfilled prophecy. Apologists like to make the point that no one individual piece of evidence is indisputable, but when taken as a whole, it unmistakably points to the conclusion that the Christian God is the one true God. but that only really works if the individual pieces of evidence are actually, you know, good. You can have good evidence that is still possible to dispute, but the evidence for the Christian God is universally bad, at least as far as I've seen. I am open to the idea that good evidence is out there somewhere, but really, with the fact that Christianity has been a thing for 2,000 years now, you'd expect that the all-powerful God who is behind it could have given us something better than faulty logical arguments and internally inconsistent books as evidence, so I'm not really holding out hope at this stage of the game.
I actually take a different perspective. I say, yes, those evidences are true. Jesus did rise from the dead. That's an historical fact that you can show.
No, that's an assertion, for which the best evidence that apologists always seem to fall back on is that a couple of decades after it was supposed to have happened, a guy wrote that 500 anonymous people witnessed a risen Jesus. There have been more witnesses to a risen Elvis than that, many of whom are still alive to this day. And yet, I would wager that most Christians accept the fact that Elvis died in 1977 and stayed dead. Despite the fact that there is much better evidence that Elvis is still alive today than there is for the resurrection of Jesus.
There is such a thing as irreducible complexity in life, that all of life gets irreducibly complex.
No, there really is not such a thing as irreducible complexity. At best, irreducible complexity is an argument from ignorance. We don't know how this particular thing evolved, therefore it must be impossible for it to have evolved. But the problem is, every time creation has come up with something that is supposedly irreducibly complex, scientists do this weird thing where they research it and answer the question of how it could have evolved, rather than just giving up and saying, must have been God. But really, all of the major examples that creationists bring up that are supposedly irreducibly complex end up having rather robust evolutionary explanations, as we saw with the cardiovascular system in Friday's video.
In other words, when you go out to the farthest reaches of the universe, all the way down to the smallest cell in the body, when you go down to DNA, you see irreducible complexity. You see language in our DNA.
No, there is no language in our DNA. Language is a rough analogy that we use as a tool to help us understand DNA, but it is not an inherent property of DNA.
Language, data, information in the human DNA.
I would agree that our DNA contains information, and whether or not it contains data depends very much on how you define data. By several definitions, it does not contain data. So you're 1 for 3, 2 if I'm generous. Let's split the difference and go 1.5. Congrats, you got 50%.
That shows that there is actually spoken word in your bottom substance.
I mean, my bottom substance certainly does do some spoken words right after a nice hearty bean burrito, but what's that got to do with anything? Okay, fart jokes aside, no, your DNA does not contain spoken words. I don't even know what that would mean or how this guy got to that conclusion.
What makes you you is language. The language of life. God spoke you into existence.
Yeah, I kind of figured that that's where you'd be going with this, but you have a whole lot of unconnected dots on your path there. To rephrase, DNA can be loosely analogized to a computer programming language, computer programming languages can be loosely analogized to spoken language, therefore your DNA contains spoken language, and that is proof that God spoke it into existence. By that logic, computer programmers have God powers, speaking their programs into existence, and that's proof that computers were magically created by the programmers who magicked the software into existence. Do you see how this doesn't follow, like, at all?
I believe all those evidences are true and valid, but here's what's important to note. The Bible comes with God's own self-attesting authority.
In other words, we shouldn't need apologetics to explain to us that God is true. God can do that for himself, right? Is that about it? Because that's kind of what I've been saying for a while now. God should be able to do that, but he doesn't. He instead decides to behave in a way that is completely indistinguishable from him just not even existing in the first place.
What I would say is this, is that we can know the Bible is true by the impossibility of the contrary.
I guess? I mean, doesn't that kind of follow from most things, though? I mean, to varying degrees, but that's a way that you could choose to look at how science progresses. Falsifiability is a big part of science. You lay out what would falsify your hypothesis, and then you try to do that. You perform experiments, take observations, do calculations, all to try and prove your hypothesis wrong. And if you should fail to prove it wrong, then it can be provisionally accepted as true. Scientists tend not to use certain terms like impossible, but the idea is the same. We know that scientific idea X is correct because despite being falsifiable, nothing has successfully falsified it yet. It is, of course, possible that something will falsify it in the future, but some ideas are so well established at this point that that would be functionally impossible. Like evolution. You could say that about evolution. We know it is true because it is impossible, given our current level of knowledge, for it to be false.
In other words, if you don't start with God's revelation, if you don't start with God as your reference point, then you can't know anything at all.
I suppose this depends on how you define knowledge, but actually, no, it doesn't. But it kind of does. Okay, so knowledge is a weird thing. It's possible for you to know something, but for that thing to not be true. So if you know that 2 plus 2 equals 5 because God said so, or actually let's go with a real example from the Bible. The Bible gives some measurements of a circular object, which if taken at face value, would have pi equal exactly 3. Of course, it's easy enough to get out of this one and still think that the Bible is inerrant. Maybe they were rounding, maybe the brim is wide and so measuring from the outside of the brim for the circumference, but the inside for the diameter provides enough wiggle room for it to work, or whatever. That's not the point I'm making. Let's just hypothetically say that the Bible says unequivocally that pi equals 3. This is demonstrably wrong, but someone who insists that the Bible is the inspired word of God could know for certain that pi does in fact equal 3, because God said so. But apologists like to confuse epistemological certainty with psychological certainty. This example is psychological certainty. It's where you can be certain of something and feel that you know it 100%, but it turns out that it's wrong despite the fact that you were certain of it. Epistemological certainty is when you are psychologically certain of something that is actually true. And there are degrees of certainty. The fact that our brains can be tricked by external stimuli leaves open the possibility that hard solipsism is true. So strictly speaking, if one admits to this possibility, then it is not possible to have 100% epistemic certainty on any matter. But the degree to which you are psychologically certain of something does not necessarily correlate with how true that thing is. And so you can assert that God gave you some special revelation that allows you to have certain knowledge, but that certainty is psychological, not epistemic, and cannot be externally demonstrated. The only purpose it serves is to make presuppositional apologists look like assholes.
Nothing. I'll give you an example of this. Remember I told you there is the myth of what? Say it loud, guys. You can talk to me. Come on now. You can talk now. The myth of neutrality. Nobody is neutral. Christians are not supposed to be, and the unbeliever, according to God, is not neutral, knows God, and rebels against God.
Of course. We all know God and are in rebellion. Saying that to me will sure convince me that you're right and I'm wrong. Okay, you know what? Maybe I was wrong earlier when I said that you can't have 100% epistemic certainty on any matter, because I am 100% certain that you are wrong when you say that you know my thoughts, and my own thoughts are really the only thing that I can be 100% certain of. Well, that and things that we know definitionally. But you're supposed to be explaining how we know the Bible is true. If you are asked how you know the contents of a book are true, and your response is to say that you know the inner thoughts and beliefs of the people who don't think that book is true, then what that tells me is that the book is likely obviously not true and requires all sorts of dancing around in order to make it less obvious that it's not true. This line of thinking that you are attempting to lead us down can only hurt your case.
Now capture this for a moment now, watch this. The unbeliever also has a worldview, don't they?
Of course they do. Yeah, when push comes to shove, nobody is 100% neutral. But again, if I ask you to show me that your book is true, and you answer by pointing out that I'm not a neutral party rather than, you know, showing me that your book is true, then again, this detracts from the point that you think you're making. if I want to show you that evolution is true, I don't start off by explaining how creationists aren't neutral when it comes to evolution. I start by presenting actual evidence for evolution.
What does it say, the atheist, say the hostile atheist, what do they believe about our origins? Evolution, right? That we evolved from lower species to up to where we're at now, fish to philosophers.
Not quite. There's no such thing as lower species. That's a misconception that's based in a very anthropocentric viewpoint, considering humans to be the end goal or target of evolution. But in actuality, because of how evolution works, every species is about equally as evolved as every other species. Sure, you can argue about whether one particular trait is better developed in one species or another, but at the end of the day, all of the species on the planet are the result of hundreds of millions of years of evolution, and it's been the same amount of time for each species, because of that whole common ancestor thing.
They have a worldview, right? That you have a worldview, they have a worldview. Now, they're asking questions like, is it true? Well, if you don't start with God, whether or not something is true is meaningless.
Why? Why would the existence of God affect how meaningful truth is? And what do you even mean by meaningless here? Reading through the various definitions of meaning, none of them really seem relevant. If there's no God, then truth is not the idea that is represented by word or phrase? That doesn't really work. If there's no God, then truth is not the idea that a person wants to express using words, signs, etc.? That doesn't really work either. If there is no God, then truth doesn't have significance? That one's at least coherent, but it's demonstrably wrong. It is a true statement that if I don't pay my mortgage for long enough, the bank will kick me out of my house. The existence of a God does not make this statement any more or less significant. It will remain significant to me even in a God's absence, because I rather enjoy not living on the street. Truth has utilitarian value. Technology is all based on what is true about the behavior of certain elements or materials when placed in certain situations. And so all of our technological advancement, which is significant, has happened because of our attempt to figure out the truth of how the universe works. And again, the existence of a God for this process is irrelevant. It is no more significant with a God than without one. In fact, I'd say if anything, it's even more significant without one, because if there is a God, that God could choose to help us figure these things out. But we figured them out for ourselves, so really, that statement is meaningless. It carries no significance, and it is incoherent when you actually think about what the words mean.
You can't get truth out of an evolutionary worldview, because, let's start with the bottom. The unbeliever that's talking to you right now saying things like, is the Bible true? Is acting like it even matters in a world that is just protoplasm bobbing around that something is actually true.
I mean, if you really want to be so reductionist in your description of life, then yes, the statement, a world that is just protoplasm bobbing around, is a true statement whether God exists or not. I mean, it's oversimplified to the point of not being true anymore, but I'm just granting that for now. The fact that life is mostly made of protoplasm is completely irrelevant to the God question. Truth matters because truth is useful. It is useful to know that which is true. There are other reasons why it matters as well, but I have never, not once, heard an apologist actually explain why it is that truth doesn't matter if there is no God. They just always state things like this as assertions that we should accept as true. I exist, and I have experiences. Why would God not existing mean that I no longer care whether my experiences are good or bad? Being able to figure out what is true is generally more conducive to good long-term experiences, and so for at least that reason, truth matters.
Think for a moment about this. The unbeliever has a brain in this skull right here, right? And they believe that in that skull is a brain that is fizzing chemicals, right?
I mean, I'm not exactly sure what you mean by fizzing chemicals, but if I assume that you're just talking about how neurochemistry works, then yes. Do you not believe in neurochemistry? Well, I mean, I've gathered by now that he doesn't believe in evolution, so honestly, that wouldn't surprise me much. But in my experience, apologists are usually perfectly happy accepting the scientific explanations for how our brain works in order to point to how complex they are, so that they can conclude that only God could have designed something so complex.
And they believe that their thoughts right now are the results of chemicals fizzing in their brain, right?
Again, pursuant to the fizzing chemicals thing just being your ridiculous oversimplification of how our brains work, yes, thoughts are produced by chemical reactions in our brains. In fact, using fMRI data, researchers have been able to not only identify nouns that a person is thinking of by comparing their fMRI data to previous fMRI data, but they've been able to figure out which noun the person was thinking of that they did not yet have fMRI data for. So my question here is, do you deny that our brains play an active role in thinking? Because I really thought that was pretty much universally agreed upon by everyone at this point.
So you've got the Christian and the unbeliever arguing over whether the Bible is true. Well, if the unbeliever believes their system, then that means they believe that their thoughts in that moment and their speech is the result of just brain gas.
Okay, we've graduated from fizzing chemicals to brain gas. Great. I'm actually really starting to agree with you on this one. Your thoughts are not being produced by a brain. Is stating that your thoughts are not generated by a brain supposed to convince me that the Bible is true? Because it's kind of doing the opposite here.
So if you start from their perspective, they have no basis for logic. They have no basis for truth.
Logic is a system of rules that we have devised to describe certain characteristics of how the universe works. So our basis for logic is reality. Do you think logic should not be based in reality? Same thing for truth. Truth is a description of reality. So again, reality is the basis for truth. Are you saying that truth should not be based in reality? Here's the thing with that. If we base truth on reality, then if God is real, the statement God is real will be a true statement. And so basing truth on reality will get us to God. If God does not exist, then using reality as the basis for truth still works because we can measure the truth of a statement by comparing it with reality. But if we base truth on God, then if God exists, the statement God is real will still be a true statement. But if God does not exist in this scenario, then that's where we lose all basis for truth. So whether you believe God is real is a true statement or not, basing truth on reality is the superior measuring stick for truth here.
They can't help saying what they're saying right now because they're just fizzing chemically.
Well, the debate between determinism and free will is another giant can of worms that I really don't want to open right now, but suffice it to say for the moment that if the God that is depicted in the Bible exists, then the debate between determinism and free will is still an issue, because the Bible never explicitly states that we even have free will, and the fact that God set everything in motion while knowing all the outcomes of every single one of his creative acts, and having the ability to have created in a different manner, thereby causing a different outcome, it kind of kills the idea of free will. But even if I grant that it's possible to have free will if Christianity is true, this doesn't actually settle the debate. It's still possible that it does not exist, and the idea of free will is suspiciously absent from the Bible, not to mention all those times when God just directly violates people's free will.
If you don't start with God, you have no basis for logic, no basis for science, the uniformity in nature, no basis for ethics.
Oh, buddy here's just throwing out all sorts of baseless assertions as though they are uncontested facts. Okay, we've already talked about logic and we kinda got to science earlier, so how about the uniformity of nature? Well, to suggest that nature relies on God to remain uniform implies that God has to work in order to stop some chaotic force from messing with nature. Does such a force actually exist? Has it been demonstrated? And didn't God create everything? Why would he create nature in such a way that it requires him to constantly fight this chaotic force? Or if nature just remains uniform on its own, then why do we need God upholding the uniformity of nature? Why can't it just stay uniform on its own? And as for ethics, they have their basis in empathy.
For example, if we don't start with God's revelation and what God says about us in this moment as we ask these questions, then is it against the rules for me to win the argument by beating you?
Now, when you say beating you, do you mean intellectually doing a better job such that it is obvious to everyone who the winner was? Or was that more along the lines of how the Bible says you're to deal with your slaves or your children when they're disobedient? Because if we're talking about winning the argument through physical force, you'll find that the Bible permits it in many places, while it is against the rules of most societies to just start beating someone you disagree with. So yes, it is against the rules, especially if we ignore the Bible.
As in physically?
Ah, there's the clarification. Well, like I said, there are scenarios in which the Bible approves of using physical violence against people that you're disagreeing with. Like, for instance, if they are your child. Or if you own them as property, which the Bible also allows. So, if you want to get ethical behavior, you'd have better luck with secular society's rules than with the rules found in the Bible.
Think for a moment now. If we take the unbeliever's worldview and a Christian, and we put a Christian and an unbeliever in a fight. They're in it now. They're in a fight, right? What's to stop me from winning the argument by putting you in a rear naked choke?
Well, one could conclude that resorting to violence is the last resort of the desperate, so I would say that such behavior would show that you had indeed lost the argument.
Not literally naked. You know what a rear naked choke is, right?
I did have to Google it, but yeah, I figured it wasn't a sex thing. Sounds like it could be a fun sex thing, though, as long as you have your safe words ready before you begin.
I don't want you guys to get the wrong images here. Rear naked choke is a martial arts move, right? There's no actual nakedness, okay?
The gentleman doth protest too much, methinks.
It's just called a rear naked choke because it's just a choke, okay?
You know, one of the joys of being an atheist is that I don't have to worry about whether or not God will get mad at me for having said something that might leave people thinking I'm into weird sex stuff. Do you think I do a sex thing that's called the rear naked choke? If so, that's fine, I don't care. It's weird that God would obsess over our sex lives anyways, and even weirder that you think he would be upset at you if you even just implied the wrong thing about sex without even doing it.
But watch this. The unbeliever has no basis to complain if you say, well, I'm going to win the debate right now by choking you out.
Why would we have no basis for a complaint in that scenario? Do you not understand what empathy is? I mean, you might be a sociopath. There are certainly sociopathic apologists out there, but most don't go out of their way to point it out. Just David Wood.
Are there rules?
Yes. In the American legal system, that's called battery, and it is most definitely against the rules. Trial by combat is typically associated with religion, with God granting victory to the person who is in the right. So, again, the secular system wins here.
Are there rules in seeking truth? Is there such a thing as integrity?
Yes, there is. Integrity is the quality of being honest and moral. Honesty is just whether or not you tell the truth to the best of your knowledge, and morality is a bit more prickly than that, but suffice it to say for now that it's entirely possible to be moral without God. I mean, he's just been asserting everything as fact so far without bringing any data to the table to back him up, so why can't I just do the same thing? Yeah, moral without God. It's possible. Fuck you.
Watch this for a moment now. You've got a Christian arguing over truth and an unbeliever arguing over truth, right? What's the Christian believe about reality? We're in the image of God. God is truth. We're commanded not to lie. We're commanded to love one another. You guys with me, right?
You're also commanded to perform animal sacrifices regularly and to execute people for supposed crimes that, even when they are actual problematic behaviors, are nowhere near serious enough to warrant the death penalty. Like disobedient children. Yes, disobedience in children can be troublesome at times. Killing them is not the solution to that problem. Sex outside of marriage, when done safely, is not even a problem. And yet the crime for that is execution. Being a gay man, execution. Notably, the books that were written when polygamy was common are silent on female homosexuality, but even when it does speak out against lesbians later on, they don't quite rise to the level of death penalty. Picking up sticks on the wrong day of the week? That's a death penalty. Rape a virgin? Well, then you have to pay her father for the property damage and then marry her, because how's he supposed to sell her after she's been used? So, yeah, the Bible does say a few things that are not morally abhorrent, but secular morality has it beat by a long shot.
What's the unbeliever's position? They believe that all of our ancestors were just bacteria.
How is that in any way relevant to where we are today? why would the answer to the question, who was your ancestor 500 million years ago, have any impact on our moral systems today? Sure, we can use evolution to explain the development of morality. In a social species, the behaviors that we consider to be moral helped with survival, and so there was a selection pressure favoring people who act morally. But how would that change whether or not morality is even a thing to begin with?
We've evolved in a meaningless, purposeless soup to where we're at today.
Again, so what? We are here now with thoughts and feelings, and one of those feelings is empathy, which is one of the stronger feelings that drives us to moral behavior. It's certainly not all there is to it, but it's a good start.
There are no absolute standards of ethics.
Right, there aren't absolute standards of ethics. Even in the Christian worldview, there aren't absolute standards of ethics. Otherwise, why did God change his mind about dietary restrictions? In the Old Testament, it was unethical to eat certain foods. They are unclean. In the New Testament, well, depending on which book you're in, they are allowed now. In the Old Testament, you stone the adulteress to death. In the New Testament, you do not. In the Old Testament, it is eye for eye, tooth for tooth, fracture for fracture. In the New Testament, it's turn the other cheek. Absolute means it never changes, it's always the same regardless of circumstances. But the Bible describes a moral code that has changed depending on which book you're reading. So you can pretend that absolute morals are a thing that exists if you want, but in reality they don't appear to exist even when looking through the Bible.
There's no ought, there's no should be, there's just what is.
Moral philosophy is a complicated beast. There are atheist philosophers who advocate for moral oughts, but again, this is rather irrelevant. We're trying to figure out whether or not the Bible is true, not whether or not moral imperatives exist. That is a secondary question, the discussion of which will be much more fruitful if we answer the first question properly. This is whataboutism at its finest. Is your book true? Morality is subjective if it isn't! That doesn't answer the question, that just raises the question of whether or not morality is subjective. I would argue that ultimately it is, because in order for something to be considered moral or immoral, you first need a subject. Without a subject, there is nothing to be moral or immoral. But that is irrelevant to whether or not the Bible itself is actually true.
And the unbeliever demands that you hold to universal laws of logic and you tell the truth when you're arguing about God.
I mean, you're welcome to lie if you think it'll help your case, and many apologists undoubtedly do. I know I've caught a number of them in pretty blatant lies. As far as adhering to logic goes, like I said, it's not that logic is some transcendental thing that orders the universe. Logic is a system that humans have worked out to describe how the universe operates. If the universe operated differently, we would have developed different laws of logic. And do you know what we don't find anywhere in the Bible? The laws of logic.
Isn't it amazing that when the unbeliever debates you, they have to secretly step off of their worldview and sneak into yours to gather things that only make sense in your worldview in order to argue against God?
In my experience, it's the apologists who do that with morality. Because if you actually read the Bible, you find that it endorses some pretty heinous immoral actions. So the apologists tiptoe over to secular morality in order to borrow some consequentialist ethics to say things like, those Canaanites were being horrible. They were engaged in practices like child sacrifice that just had to be put to a stop. When if their moral system were actually the real moral system, simply saying God commanded it, therefore it must have been morally good, should suffice.
Cornelius Van Til, who I think arguably is one of the greatest philosophers in the history of the Christian church.
Just to give you guys a peek into how great his philosophy was, the first sentence in the Wikipedia article about him is, Cornelius Van Til was a Dutch-American Calvinist philosopher and theologian who is credited as being the originator of modern presuppositional apologetics. If invented presuppositionalism is the first thing that someone sees when they read about someone, then I would argue that that person is probably one of the worst philosophers in history, history of the Christian church or otherwise.
Said this, the unbeliever is like a small child who smacks their father in the face. The child is dependent upon their father to hold them in his lap in order to reach.
Okay, so he used a goofy analogy to illustrate a nonsensical point. Good job, I guess?
So when the unbeliever says, how do I know that Bible's true? What I say is, well, we can do the evidences and look at history and all those things. All those things really are amazing and glorious. But the truth is, fundamentally, if you don't start your knowledge and your seeking truth with God's revelation, you're reduced to a fool. You're reduced to absurdity.
Because the best way to have a productive discussion is to just start off by hurling insults. Everybody knows that.
When someone says, how do I know the Bible is true? I would say this, if you don't start with God, you can't know anything at all, and truth is meaningless.
And then we know that you're just full of shit. That's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Yigit Kan Yilmaz, sorry for probably mispronouncing that horribly, who says, as an engineering student, it always gets on my nerves when people claim that something being complex means it was designed. The point of design is to make things do things with as simple a mechanic as possible, because guess what? The more complex it gets, the more easily it breaks. I would assume that an infinitely powerful and knowledgeable God would be able to design something a lot more competent and simple than the human body. And there you have it from someone studying engineering. Simplicity is the hallmark of good design, not complexity. Thanks for watching. Before we go, I am starting my annual November fundraiser for Project Share Niagara. They are primarily a food bank, but they also provide assistance with finding affordable housing, paying off late bills, they run a homeless shelter, and they even help with things like transportation costs for medical appointments. My point is, they do a lot of good, and they help thousands of families in the Niagara region every month. Last year, we raised over $5,000 for them, and I'm hoping to at least match that this year. To kick things off, I will personally match the first $250 of donations that come in, effectively making that first $250 that you guys kick in double up to $500, giving us a nice healthy start. I'm hoping that'll be done before Wednesday's video. Don't let me down, guys. So head on over to vicerhino.com/donate to join in on the War on Christmas, or whatever. I guess not really War on Christmas stuff. If everyone who watches this video just gives a dollar, we will fly right past that goal. So make coffee at home one morning instead of going out for it, if that's what it takes. So thanks again for watching, thanks for donating, and special thanks as always to my patrons, Jeffrey Dahmer, Mark McManus, Mark Ketchum, Clench Eastwood, Lynn Dobbs, and all the rest, who are the fizzing chemicals that drive the brain that is my channel. If you'd like to be neurology gas, you can join us on Patreon for as little as a dollar per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist, links to social media, all the ways to support the channel, and to my other projects like my podcast with my daughter can be found at links.vicerhino.com. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my PO Box address is in the description. See you next time!